as an officer, we don't feel safe.
What about Carl Nice? I haven't heard his name.
Well, he's on the list of the million-dollar cops, right? He's one of the many cops who have been disciplined and then are back with no accountability. So, I mean, there's a list of Portland police officers that if the public had their way, they would no longer be Portland police officers.
Yeah, he's a sergeant now in East Precinct.
Right, I know.
You know, I might say, too, that right now we hear there's a shortage of officers, 40 positions to be filled.
Yes.
This is not a time just to fill positions.
Yes. Right.
It's a time to be very strategic. And those 40 positions at least begin by the effort of filling them with officers of color and from various backgrounds. This police force is woefully inadequate in terms of representation of who we are as a community and who will be in years to come. So I call upon the mayor to be strategic and not just to start filling positions, but do it in a very intentional way that will help transform policing in this city.
Do you feel that as citizens, we have a moral duty to push the other city councilors to pass a binding ordinance to go against the mayor's decision and appeal this to the Supreme Court?
I hope that we have a majority of the city council who feels as strongly as we do that it is unacceptable to have Fresh Hour on the Portland Police Bureau in any capacity. And all you need is a majority of the city council to say that we're going to appeal the Oregon Court of Appeals decision. They could do that, but they've been woefully silent so far.
Thank you.
Yes.
I was just wondering, the letter that you read, did you get that yesterday?
No, actually, that was written in 2012.
2012. Have you been in touch with her about this latest?
Yes.
Can you share just kind of, did she have anything she wanted to share with the community or with us?
She's actually writing a written statement, and it wasn't ready in time for this press conference, so that statement will be forthcoming. But she was very distressed that media is all piled up at her house, right? Even though she doesn't live in Portland anymore, you guys are all at her doorstep trying to get a quote, and she will give you a quote when she has done developing that quote. And we'll make sure the media gets it.
Yes. So I wanted to see, you mentioned the Millionaires Club of Portland, and I know about it, but a lot of these other people don't know about it, and I'd like to hear more about the Millionaires Club.
Well, that's not really a term that we use. There's at least one officer who's cost the city $1 million in cumulative lawsuits, Sergeant Leo Besner, and he was involved in a shooting that also cost the city, it cost the city $500,000. He shot somebody in the back who was unarmed at the time, much like Officer Frashauer. But Officer Frashauer cost the city $1 million in this case. So there are several, and the officers involved in the James Chassie killing cost the city over $1 million. The officer who accidentally loaded his beanbag shotgun with a live round cost the city over $2 million. So there's quite a few officers but that officer not only is no longer on the force, but he committed suicide earlier this year. But there's also, somebody mentioned Kyle Nice and the officers who killed James Chassie. Two of them were Portland police officers. One was a Multnomah County Sheriff's deputy, but he now works for the Bureau. Those two officers were suspended not because they beat James Chassie to death, but because they didn't bring him to the hospital after they used a taser on him. And that was also overturned by the arbitrator. So we have a pattern of arbitration overturning findings about violence against our community members.
And that was the Albina Ministerial Alliance's press conference about Wednesday's court ruling on the reinstatement of Portland police officer Ron Frashauer. To hear the rest of the Q&A with the press assembled at the event, you can go to kboo.fm and find a stream or downloadable MP3 of that program. For now, this is Green Sky Bluegrass with Don't Lie, a message that some folks in Portland in positions of power need to hear. Don't lie. Thank you, boys. That was Green Sky Bluegrass giving us a little taste of Don't Lie from the Northwest String Summit right outside of town. I believe that was held at Horning's Hideout. Next, we hear an update on the status of Mumia Abu-Jamal and an interview with Miko Peled on his book, The General's Son. Right here, right now, on KBOO Portland, your community radio.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Mumia Abu-Jamal has gone to federal court in Scranton, Pennsylvania, to get an order compelling the state of Pennsylvania to provide him with medical care for hepatitis C. We speak today with Pennsylvania reporter David Lindorf. Lindorf has been covering the ongoing Mumia hearing. The hearing before federal judge Robert Mariani has so far shown that the Corrections Department of Pennsylvania has a policy of denying any treatment for chronic hepatitis C and maintains a just revealed protocol that calls for denying care and monitoring inmates while the virus ravages the body, causing irreversible organ damage. David Lindorf, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me on.
You were at the trial the first day and you've been following it. Can you bring us up to date?
This is a really crucial hearing for Mumia because since January, he's been having a serious medical crisis, which initially nobody understood what was wrong. His skin was turning into like what he called dragon skin, and his doctor called elephant, it looked like elephant skin, blistered, thick, dark, blacker than his natural black skin, itching like crazy. And then he also had elevated blood glucose levels that they didn't even know about because they weren't testing until he, in March, collapsed in a diabetic coma and was rushed to the hospital. And finally, they diagnosed it as diabetes, which he had never had. They treated all of this stuff symptomatically. You know, they gave him insulin. They gave him ointments for the skin. And actually, they were putting cortisone on, which is pretty dangerous to do for, you know, overuse. And finally, when he got to a hospital, they really figured it out. But what needed to be done with the diabetes. But what they didn't do was check his hepatitis infection, because when he went to the prison in 2012, to the general population prison, they did a screening and found out, as they do, I guess, for most prisoners, and they found that he had contracted hep C at some point.
Now that they know he's got hepatitis C, there's a medicine that they could give him for it. Why aren't they giving him the medicine? Isn't that what the hearing's
well,
all about?
Here's the deal. We have a new member of our This Can't Be Happening.net, Jess Gu, who's a radical young doctor at a public health clinic now in Seattle. And she looked at his records and stuff and looked into this. And she said, the situation is that normally, even outside of the prison, if you get hep C, the normal treatment has been not necessarily to treat it unless it's active, just monitor it, because there are side effects to the medications. And so if people test positive to the virus but it's not doing anything, you periodically you can get rid of it with these new medications that to only take 12 weeks and the side effects aren't so bad. But it's hugely expensive. It's like $85,000 for the course of treatment. But she said it would be all right to not treat it if you're monitoring for cirrhosis of the liver or, you know, the various things that could happen and measuring viral load periodically. But they didn't do any of that with Mumia. They just said, oh, you were infected. And they never tested since 2012 to see how active it was. And apparently what the suspicion is that it started getting active. And when they only in May finally tested him with his blood level, and it was very high.
Isn't he now asking, though, that he be given this medicine, and they're denying it to him?
Yeah, well, this is Dr. Jess Gu said that the absolute proper treatment, according to guidelines, is if you have an active case of hep C, you don't have a choice. You have to treat it, or it'll kill you. So you know, he should be getting treated. But in Pennsylvania, they don't treat. In some states, they do. In New York, in Connecticut, in a number of states, that they treat for Hep C if it's an active case. I think in some states, they actually treat anyway. But Mumia, even though they know that he's got this active case, that he has liver damage, and that it's caused his diabetes too, they are not treating him.
That's in line with what our friend Francis Golden, who's one of the leaders of the Free Mumia campaign, believes, that they are now and have always been trying to execute him, and this is just another way to do it. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, medical execution.
So, David, at stake here, I guess, is not just the fate of Mumia, but other prisoners who are similarly situated. If the judge rules in Mumia's favor, then the state's going to have to come up with the money to treat other prisoners as well. Is that true?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, you know, Mumia's family and support group have offered to pay for the treatment. So, you know, if they'll allow him, they wouldn't even allow a private physician to examine him. There was an expert doctor brought in from New York to testify in this case, and that doctor, who's an internist and specializes in this stuff, he saw Mumia only because they wouldn't let him come in and examine him, but he came in as an ordinary visitor, and he looked at the visible signs of this skin rash and looked at Mumia as he was able. He wasn't allowed to undress him and, you know, do a full exam, but he was able to talk to him and look at him, see his eyes, look at his, you know, the soft tissues on his eyes to see if there was liver damage and other things. And he was able to deduce that, yes, he has Hep C, and yes, he has a diabetes, and yes, he needs to be treated. And so he testified about that. That they could bring in a doctor if the court ordered it, and then they could treat him that way. Or, you know, the doctor could simply order the hospital to treat him, you know, send him to the hospital and have him treated. But it would certainly look terrible to have him go to court and get this treatment under a federal court order without other prisoners getting. There are 10,000 prisoners in Pennsylvania with Hep C, and usually a fair percentage of those are active cases statistically. You know, you would think the judge would simply say that this is unacceptable, and I suppose the judge could go beyond the injunction's request for Mumia to get treatment and order treatment for all prisoners.
Yeah, or a second lawsuit could be brought as a class action.
There is a second lawsuit that was brought in Pittsburgh. So there is an ongoing case that's, you know, moving through the courts. But the thing about Mumia is it adds urgency to the case because he collapsed within a diabetic coma and so on.
David, we've run out of time, and we thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thank you again. Miko Peled is an Israeli writer and activist currently living in the United States. He was born and raised in Jerusalem. His grandfather was a signer of the Israeli Declaration of Independence in 1948, and his father, the late General Mati Peled, was one of the generals in the 1967 Israeli-Arab War. Driven by a personal family tragedy to explore Palestine, its people, and their narrative, he has written a book about his journey from the sphere of the privileged Israeli to that of the oppressed Palestinians. His book is titled The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. He supports the creation of a single democratic state in all of Palestine, and he is a supporter of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. Miko Peled, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Miko, you come from a distinguished Israeli family. Tell us about your grandfather and your father and your mother and your sister.
Well, I come from a very patriotic Zionist family, a family that has had its hand in the establishment of the State of Israel from the very, very beginning. From the early beginnings of the Zionist movement. My grandfather was Avram Katznelson, who was one of the early leaders of the Zionist movement. He was a signer on the Israeli Declaration of Independence. this was my maternal grandfather, my mother's on my mother's side. On my father's, my father was a matipelet. He was an officer in 1948, and he remained in the Israeli army, and he was a general. He was one of the, he was a member of the Israeli high command during the 1967 war and the years leading up to the 1967 war. And then after that war, he began to advocate this idea that today we know is a two-state solution, whereby the Palestinian question would be resolved by allowing the Palestinians to establish a small state in two areas that Israel determined, which are the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And then for the rest of his life, the remainder of his life, or actually the second half of his life, he was a proponent of this two-state solution and the peace agreement that would hopefully, or he was hoping, would come as a result of the solution, which we know never materialized, never happened. And yes, about my sister, she lost her daughter in a suicide attack in Jerusalem in 1997. She became a very strong advocate of peace and a very strong critic of the state of Israel, and she had written a book. She's an educator. She had written a book called Palestine and Israeli School Books, which analyzes closely the Israeli education system, concluding that it is a systemically racist education system, which is very similar to the types of education systems we find in other racist societies. And then I am the author of The General Son, and I've been active for the last probably 15, almost 20 years as well on this issue. My take is slightly different. I'm a strong anti-Zionist. I have a strong anti-Zionist approach. My call is to support BDS and to establish a secular democratic state.
When you were growing up, what was the narrative about Zionism that you were taught? You've written that the story on which I was raised was a lie. So could you talk about what the narrative was that you were raised on and why it's a lie?
The Zionist narrative claims that we, the Jewish people, have returned to our rightful land, our rightful homeland, after 2,000 years in exile, that we are the descendants of the ancient Hebrews who used to live in that land some 2,000 or 3,000 years ago, and therefore it is ours, and now we are back to reclaim it. Because we are reasonable people, we accepted the partition resolution of 1947, allowing the Palestinians to remain, or the Arabs of Israel to remain, and have some portion of the country as their own. And then they attacked us. We defended ourselves. We won. We asked the Arabs to stay, and they all left. So the refugee problem is not our problem. They choose to leave, and they left. And that's it, and that's the end of the story. And since then, we've been defending ourselves against Arabs who want to kill us. That's, in a nutshell, the Zionist narrative.
And the other side, the Palestinian narrative?
Well, the Palestinian narrative is interesting because, of course, the Palestinian narrative is a narrative that talks about dispossession and ethnic cleansing and terrorism of which they were victims. And nobody really accepted that narrative until about, I'd say, 20 or 15 years ago when Israeli historians began validating that. When they looked into the Israeli archives and they looked at this history and they began to validate, and I read their accounts, and then I began traveling and meeting Palestinians and hearing their accounts, which is how I became familiar with the Palestinian narrative, which is not really talked about in the West and certainly not talked about in Israel. And so that was my introduction to it, and it talks about a massive campaign, well-planned, well-thought-out, of ethnic cleansing. I would call it genocide. That began as early as the Zionists were able to do it, but certainly immediately after the partition resolution of November 1947. It's a campaign of dispossession that continues to this day, an attempt to destroy the Palestinian people, take their land, and get rid of them as quickly as possible.
You were in the special forces in the Israeli army. You wore a red beret, and now you don't even live in Israel anymore. You live in San Diego, and you write that your journey to Palestine began in San Diego. How so?
Well, growing up, I grew up in Jerusalem, and probably even more so than any other Israeli city. Jerusalem is a segregated racist city. It's supposedly a mixed city, but it's a segregated racist city. And just like Israelis everywhere else around the country, you don't meet Palestinians, you don't know Palestinians, you don't see Palestinians. There's no interaction, there's no connection whatsoever, no relations whatsoever. So you grow up as an Israeli never meeting Palestinians. Is what, to grow up as an Israeli never meeting Palestinians is very common. My journey began in San Diego because that is where I began meeting Palestinians and hearing the Palestinian story and getting in touch with Palestinian, the Palestinian narrative for the first time. That's why I say my journey into Palestine began in San Diego, because it was through that that I was able to then go back and begin this journey, you know, like a subtitle of a book, as of an Israeli in Palestine, recognizing that there is a Palestine and venturing from my very safe and comfortable and privileged sphere as an Israeli to the sphere of the other, which is a very, very different sphere. It's a very short journey geographically, but it's a huge journey mentally and psychologically.
Miko, why do you say that the notion of a Jewish state is a crazy racist notion?
Because I believe it is. There's no reason that could possibly justify the establishment of a Jewish state or the creation of a Jewish state, certainly not in an Arab country, which is what Palestine is. Jews are not a nation. They're not a nationality. They're a religion. There are Argentinian Jews and Polish Jews and Russian Jews and French Jews and American Jews. And so this notion that Jews are a nationality is one of the myths that the Zionist movement created. Therefore, the idea that you establish a state for Jews only, particularly in a country where there are others who are not Jews, is a crazy racist idea.
Well, Miko, this is Abdin Jabara, and I have your book here, The General Son, in front of me, and you refer to the Palestinians and the Jews as two nations in this book at points. And I'm just wondering about this whole issue about whether we have to fight and win the idea that Jews are only a religious group and not does not have a national characteristic before we can solve this problem. Because I understand from you in your advocacy of a single democratic state with equal rights that you do not recognize any national rights that Jews might have. Is that correct?
Well, I think you have to differentiate Jews and Israelis. I don't think Jews have any kind of national identity, but Israelis are a new creation. You know, I compare them to the whites in South Africa. They're not organic, they're not indigenous, but they are part of South Africa now. There's nothing anybody can do about that. Israelis are this new creation of Jews who immigrated and colonized, or not immigrated, but came to colonize Palestine. So Israelis are now this new national identity and cultural identity, and they are Israelis. So I don't think Jews have any kind of rights to Palestine. However, the reality is that half of the people who reside in Palestine today are Israelis, like myself. It's a different, they're not Arabs, they're not Palestinians, they're Israelis. So we do have two nations there that exist there, and I don't think there's any expectation that anybody's going to leave or go anywhere. We're talking about 6 million Palestinians and about almost 6 million Israelis. So that is the reality that exists today. And again, I don't think it's a Jewish issue. I think it's the two nations that we need to be discussing are the Palestinians and the Israelis.
So you're considering the Israelis as a nation. Is that correct?
The Israelis are this new nation, yes, this new creation. Okay. Absolutely.
Now, you, I'm sure, follow the polls in Israel and understand what people's attitudes are. And I'm just wondering, on the basis of those polls, do you have any sense about how many Israeli Jews would find your proposal for a solution to the conflict acceptable?
None whatsoever. But I don't think that's the issue. I don't think this is going to be resolved as a result of Israelis accepting this. I think it's going to be resolved as Israelis waking up one morning and realizing there's a new reality in spite of what they might want. I think if we took a poll of white South Africans, they would have preferred apartheid to remain the reality in South Africa, but there was boycott, divestment, sanctions. South Africa was isolated, and the white apartheid regime had no choice but to fall, and the whites had no choice but to accept a new reality where they live as equals with black Africans. And Israelis, I believe, this is exactly the reality that's going to take place. It's not going to happen as a result of negotiations or concessions or Israelis suddenly waking up one morning and agreeing. It's going to be a reality where the force of the resistance, both from within and without, overpowers the reality of the Zionist state, the state of Israel. And an Israeli prime minister, just like de Klerk in South Africa, will step up one day and say, you know, we're calling for the release of all the prisoners and free one-person, one-vote elections for everyone.
There are at least a million Israelis that are living either in the United States or in Western Europe. To what extent is this message of a single democratic state more acceptable to them?
I don't think there's any difference. Most Israelis, even Israelis who live overseas, support the state of Israel. But, you know, there's immigration in and out of every country. I think that's a natural course of things. Most Israelis, I don't expect they're going to leave one way or the other. So I think the reality is that we have Israelis in Palestine, just like we have Palestinians. That's the reality that we need to move forward, with which we need to, you know, move forward. So I think Israelis and Palestinians can live in peace and can share Palestine, can have a peaceful coexistence, but not in the context of or in the framework of the state of Israel, only in the context where they are treated as equals in a democracy, which is not a Jewish state, but the state of all of its people.
Well, there have been four majority Arab or majority Arab-Palestinian parties in Israel that recently formed a joint list. They were forced to do so because of a new law that was passed by the Knesset that required parties to get a certain percentage of votes before they could stand for election in the Knesset. This party, the joint list, as you know, is now headed by Ayman Oda, who recently visited the United States. My question is, do you have any sense about how many Jews voted for the United List?
Well, the very progressive, not many, but the very progressive fringe Israelis that voted for them. But this is the very, very fringe left. Most of the Israeli, what used to be the Israeli Zionist left, voted for other parties. So these would be Israelis who are non-Zionist or who are, basically non-Zionist and don't believe in the Zionist call. But not many, but certainly enough to make a little bit of a difference.
I think that all pro-Palestinian activists would like to see a radical transformation in the Palestinian situation and end to the massive oppression that they have faced on a daily basis, both before and after 1948. And I'm just wondering, from what I hear, that you think that there's going to be some leader, some Israeli leader is going to emerge like a de Klerk and say, well, we've got to change, and we've got to give rights to these people. Do you really think that that is a realistic expectation?
No, not at all, not at all. Let me rephrase it, because that's not what I meant. So let me correct that. What I meant to say is that, like de Klerk, there will be an Israeli prime minister who will be forced, as a result of the total isolation, boycotts, and divestments, and so forth, not out of the goodness of his heart or out of some kind of magnanimity, but as a result of lack of choice. De Klerk didn't do what he did because he woke up one morning feeling magnanimous. He did what he did because apartheid was dying and South Africa was isolated and there was nowhere to go. There was no other choice. It was complete surrender. So I foresee an Israeli prime minister one day in the same position, forced to stand up and surrender, basically, like De Klerk did.
Do you see that the West, the United States, and European countries are going to provide the same kind of isolation of Israel that they ultimately provided for South Africa that led to de Klerk's seeing the light?
Absolutely. I don't think de Klerk saw the light. I think de Klerk just saw that there was no choice. But yeah, I think absolutely that's exactly how it's going to be.
You criticize the new measures by the Europeans to label the goods from the settlements that are being sold in Europe. You say that all of Israel is being occupied. It's not just the West Bank. It's not just Gaza. And to single out these settlement products is nonsensical, if that's what I understand your position.
Yeah, I think I don't think that hope is going to come necessarily of the current European or American regimes. It's going to come as a result of greater greater grassroots pressure on them to move forward. What the Europeans have been doing with the recognition of the Palestinian state and this new law about the labels is trying to, within the framework of the reality that exists today, which recognizes the occupation of Palestine, to show some measure of resistance and say, look, we're doing something for the Palestinians. So we're recognizing a state that does not exist. We're pretending that there is a Palestinian ambassador, although there is no Palestinian state, so the ambassador represents no one. Along that same line, they're saying, well, we're going to label these, we're going to consider those particular areas as illegal settlements, and those are the ones that we're going to label. And then go figure out exactly which ones are they're going to consider as illegal and which ones are not. You know, how exactly they're going to do this is a whole other question. So it's a small measure that just to relieve some of the pressure and show that they are showing some measure of respect and solidarity with the Palestinian cause, but in effect doing nothing. You know, if they wanted to really do something, they would say we are boycotting all Israeli products because all of Israel is occupied Palestine. All Israeli towns and cities are illegal settlements, which is what they are. The occupation of 48 was no more legal than the occupation that, you know, that took place in 1967, and one was a continuation of the other. If they wanted to do something, they would say, we recognize that all of Palestine is occupied, that Palestinians live under an oppressive apartheid regime that needs to end, not recognize a state that doesn't exist and a government that represents no one, which is really what the Palestinian Authority is. So if the Europeans, but I believe that this is coming. I think right now the Europeans are behaving the way they are because they can get away with it. I think future European governments are not going to be able to get away with it because the pro-Palestinian voice in Europe is getting stronger and louder, and their constituents are going to demand that they do more.
We've been speaking with Mikko Peled, the author.